ready to roll?
Yep, thank you.
Well, hi, everybody. I am Karen, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Karen.
Delighted to be here, and I know everybody in this room here practically. And I heard the groups were small here, but thank you so much for asking me, because I appreciate the fact that you guys are really, you and Oscar, trying to get this thing going again and being creative. I'm just excited about it, to see Intergroup have some new blood, some new energy to, so I just really want to support it, and I hope we can all support it and have it be like it is. It's perfect. Everything in life is perfect. Just for today. So anyway, thank you for asking me. And thank you, Rochelle. I asked Rochelle to be the speaker with me, because I remember when she was struggling to get sober. And that's a fabulous thing, of sharing our experience, strength, and hope with people when we go to meetings and we see them struggle. We don't enjoy it, but to see people, we hear reports about how I was when I first got here. And I just love hearing those reports. I cannot believe, I think, oh God, did I do that really? And I guess I did. It doesn't make any difference. The fact is, I'm sober today, so it all works. But I want to say this now. I'm a free monster. I remember it wasn't fashionable for a while to mention that you went to Fremont, but nobody, you just kind of didn't talk about it. But it's very fashionable, very chic to have been a free monster. And I went to Fremont last night, and I had forgotten how much fun it was. It was crazy, but it was loud and funny and insane, and yeah, it was birthday night, and no, it was a real hoot. I can't say might be a while before I go back, but because I've been one of those that has said it's time that Fremont is retired, you know, put to rest, it's done its duty. But after experiencing it last night, I take that back. It has a place, and it's principles before personalities, and I love principles before personalities. It's one of my very, very favorite slogans, or whatever, euphemisms, whatever we call them, in this program, and I'm so grateful for all of them. But anyway, I just had to interject that about Fremont, because Fremont's a big part of my story, a big part of it. Because I often say I wouldn't be sober today if it wasn't for Fremont. But okay, I'm born and raised in Seattle, Washington. Lived as a child though in Alaska. We had a mine up in Cougar Rock Creek and up in Nome. And my aunt had a hotel in Nome. And so as a child, was raised up there, and came back to came outside. During those days, it was the olden days, you came outside, you just didn't get on an airplane. It was a project to get in and out, because there's no boat. The boats would come in, and you would go out in the first of the spring, and you could go back and forth, and then when everything iced up, you didn't get back out again, or in, until the following spring. So it was quite a project. But anyway, lived there as a child, and then came back to the city, the Seattle. And my dad was an alcoholic. My mother was an untreated Al-Anon, and it was not. She was a God lover. She sacrificed for us girls. You have no idea. I have to remember. Oh, please, Mom. But that's how it was. And she let us know quite regularly. But although in a lot of ways, my mother did some really great things for my sister and myself. There was a lot of responsibilities for her. I was raised in a household that just wasn't quite right. Now, I knew it wasn't right, but I didn't know why it wasn't right. It just wasn't right. And I knew it inside. Something was always there, that this house is not right. And the years as a child, I think a lot of kids grow up, I know, and not everybody turns out to be an alcoholic, but I think that had a big influence on me as a child because of my growing situation. Like I said, my father was alcoholic, and he'd come down from Alaska, and Well, he'd come down home with a big pocket full of money, but we wouldn't see him for a couple of weeks while he would party in downtown Seattle. And then he'd come to the house and he'd stay. And I can't remember. As a kid, I can't remember how long he stayed, but he'd stay. And then there'd be the big fight and he would go back up to Alaska again. And that's kind of, it was a repetitious of a kind of over and over, year in and year out of that. And well, there were times that he would stay in town, but it was always the alcohol. The alcohol ruled. And that was one of the things that wasn't right in our house. Then in the house, my grandmother was blind, and there were some other issues there too. And it just was never comfortable. As a kid, I just was never comfortable. So, my dad, I'm sure, had a big influence on that with his alcoholism. And then I had my first drink. I remember I got sick as a dog, just sick. Oh, I vomited all. I paid attention when you said yours, because while mine was very similar, there was nothing fun and games about it. It wasn't ha-ha, tee-hee, isn't there? I had a good time. I got so sick, but I went and did it again. At that time, there was a Venetian Theater, was up there at 15th and Pine. And then the Cottage, there was a restaurant named The Cottage. It was a big hangout for Seattle youth people. And my friends, I remember, we used to go in there, and I went in there and I was drunk, and what was I, 15, 14, 15, something, I don't know, whatever I wasn't old enough, and I remember the manager, the owner-manager, put me out. Now my friends stayed, and I sat out there in the parking lot. I remember that so vividly. And the shame, all of them, the complete, just, what is that word, total
demoralization.
That's it. Anyway, so that was there as a young woman, as a young girl. And that was not a clue. I went and did it again and again and again. And it never got any better. Well, yes, it got better. I learned how to drink. For years, of course, then I had to go through the juvenile detention. I got caught driving a car. Well, I didn't steal the car, but there was some issues about the ownership. It wasn't me who stole it. It was the guys in the back seat that stole it. And but I'm the one who went to the juvenile home. So anyway, I spent a little time in there too. Now, that's when they wanted to put me into Grand Mound or whatever it was for girls down there in the south end of this Washington state. And my mother said, no, that was labeled a incorrigible. I was an incorrigible at 16 years old. I didn't even know what that meant. And I looked it up and it said beyond reform. Beyond reform. I was thinking when after I sobered up, I really thought about that. It bothered me. And I thought, you know, really should take that word on. I do not think it was fair to label a child. And at 16, you're still a child. I was still a child. Incorrigible. Beyond reform. Now that means there's no, you know, why bother? There's no help for her. And that's kind of how it went from there. So therefore, I became a real juvenile delinquent. Now, I was never a bad juvenile delinquent per se. I didn't break windows or any of that kind of stuff. But I drank and smoked a lot of weed dealt a lot of dope. And I laugh about it now. I think, oh, she had no idea, had no clue what was going on. And I think about it and I think, oh my God, if I'd gotten busted at that time, I mean, I'd still be in jail. They would put me in some corner jail, somewhere, and I'd be a silly old lady sitting in a corner cell somewhere. What's she here for? I don't know, sold dope when she was 16. that's a time when there was no, either or, you either were. I was incorrigible, I was beyond reform. So therefore, there was no help available. Well, anyway, I kind of grew out of that and went on to other things and continued on. But the alcohol, I don't think the alcohol got so bad until a little bit later when I was actually taught how to drink. Now, I started drinking with when I was drinking cocktails. Something with slow gin. I like that slow gin stuff, you know, pink, reddish, whatever it was. And then I went to Las Vegas. When I think of how bold I was, I really can't get over how bold I was. That was just damn the torpedoes, full steam ahead. And I went to Las Vegas. I had an aunt and uncle down there, and they were involved in the gambling industry. And I went down there and drinking my slow gin, whatever it was, I can't remember. It had gin in it. It was pink, red, I don't know. And I started, they taught me how to drink scotch and soda, how to order scotch and soda. Oh, that was so cool. Cutty Sark, I think it was. And then what was it? Jim Beam. And I don't know. They were all, I look at the labels on scotch bottles, booze bottles, when I do rarely go into a lounge and I see all these. I don't even recognize any of the booze they sell anymore. Now the labels I drank are no longer there. They're gone. There's all these other new things. And all kinds of new drinks, too, that I've never tasted. Anyway, I could go on and on about drinking and all the episodes, but they're no different than anybody else's. I never went to jail. Guess I have my only episode in jail was my when I was a junior flip. Not that I shouldn't have gone, but there's no need of going into all that stuff. It's kind of silly. It was also dumb. I look back on my drinking and I think, Jesus, that was dumb. It was, the whole thing was just stupid. Anyway, so I married my first husband and met him down Madison Park in Seattle down here. I saw these shoulders on the beach there, and I said, oh, yeah, that's it. I'm in love, you know. But that's how I base my relationships. Lots of whatever. Lots of lust. That was about it. Anyway, we hooked up, and I had a lovely daughter out of that. We were married less than a year. Got a lovely daughter out of that deal. My choices. I've always made such horrible choices. Everything was on impulse. It was just for the moment, for the right now. Let's do it now. But I got a lovely daughter out of the deal who I love dearly. But anyway, that didn't work, like I say, less than a year, long enough for her to be. Then I met my second husband. And who was basically a good guy, but he was a drug abuser. Now, I was drinking, but he was into drugs. But he was a good provider, a good husband, and a good father. All of those other things. I mean, somehow or another, he balanced it all, and I balanced it all, and we just lived our nice little happy life of Susie Homemaker and. Good-looking husband, house, the whole nine yards. We were a nice couple. And we're going down the highway of life and doing just fine. And then the wheels came off. Then the wheels came off and it hit the fan or however you want to say it. So that day, I knew I was in trouble with booze. There was no doubt about it. My husband had already hinted to the fact that I might have an alcohol problem. And of course, there was big fights about that. And I remember one time we went to a cocktail party and I had one drink and I announced when I got home, I said, did you know I had one drink? Now, when I think about that, a normal drinker doesn't have to announce that they have one drink. It's not a big deal. But I announced to him that I had one drink, like I should get a brownie badge or something for that. And I had my one drink. Okay. So he wasn't impressed. Fights. It was a mess. The whole thing was just a bloody mess. And so one day we are in downtown Seattle and we're having lunch with these friends. And something happened. Something happened. And I couldn't get focused. My whole mind went just caca. I just couldn't get focused. And anyway, rushed home, called the crisis clinic, and I announced to the crisis clinic that I was an alcoholic. And they said to go to the alcohol. But at that time, there wasn't any treatment places. There was Shadles out there in Boonies somewhere, and movie stars would come to up there, or doctors and well, that kind of stuff. But it really wasn't like it. What happened later? That's another part of what happened back in the later 70s. So I went down there and I talked to this nice lady. God, she was a lovely. Lovely Betty Chamberlain. She's long gone now, but she was a lovely, lovely woman. And she always just said, she says, "Oh, you were so easy." She just reeled me in. She says, "You were just so easy," and I didn't know what else to do. Being the people pleaser I was, because I've always had those kind of issues, I said to her, "You know, anything that she had asked me to do, I would have done." So anyway, she says, "Go home, and this lady will call you, and she'll pick you up and take you to a meeting." I went home. And this woman came and came to pick me up. And I will always remember my husband was coming in and he gave me that disgusted look of, and I was going to sacrifice myself into this world of sobriety, whatever that was. I remember that Betty Chamberlain said, "Well, why don't you try Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "I don't need Alcoholics Anonymous. I just tell me what to look out for. And when I get that certain feeling, so I'll know and I won't drink. Just tell me what I..." And she just smiled at me. She said, "Why don't you try Alcoholics Anonymous?" And she did that several times. But, well, she was so nice. So I said, okay, I'll go. So I went. And I got to that meeting crying. And you guys were just so glad I was there. Nobody was glad. By the time I got to AA, nobody was glad I was anywhere. Mm-hmm. I was fairly persona non grata just about every place. Just trust me. Because I would go on those running drunks. I would run hard and heavy. If you got in my way, I just kind of pushed it aside. And I just did what I wanted. The first thing that jumped out at me in that big book when I read it, when I finally got around to reading it, was self will run riot. And that was me. That describes me to a T. Self will run riot. Okay, so I went to my first meeting, and everybody was so kind to me. Just welcome. We're glad you're here. We're really glad you're here. In fact, the one person who came up to me after the meeting, Gordy, a guy named Gordy, he said, "Well, welcome. We're glad you're here. And we're still friends today." He's got a year more than I do. He was sober a year, but that's one line in this program I dearly love is welcome. We're glad you're here. That new person, the primary purpose, stay sober, carry the message. And I really believe that's what it's all about. But anyway, so I went to my second meeting was Fremont. Well, I thought, I think I can do this. And it was just a hoot. So I was down there for several years. And at that time, you have to remember, there were no other meetings. There were no meetings. At that, we had 90, that book, our intergroup book, there were 93 meetings. Now there's what, 1,300, 1,200, something like that. But 93. So there was not a lot of choices. So people came to Fremont. You had doctors, professional people, and you had the projects. And it was... We all did it together. It was so cool. I just loved it because we had a little bit of everything. So I became a regular down there, and it worked into my daughter was still a little girl. And so it worked into my schedule real good. My husband was working, my daughter was just going to a preschool. And so it worked. It worked. And I was very involved down there for several years. So one time I thought, well, I'll take my mother down so she can get the spirit, get the feeling, and get all the Fremont. So I took my mother down there, and after the meeting, I said, "Well, what'd you think?" She says, "I think it's time you were weaned away from this place." Yeah. She didn't get the spirit, but I got it, and that's what counted. So anyway, and it was time. I moved on after that, and I've been very involved in service for many. So I've been sober well over half my life, so a lot of my story actually is not about the blood and gore of drinking. It's more or less about the joy of being sober. The joy of being sober. Even when it has been hitting the fan in my life, I can honestly say I have always thought, thank you, God, for my sobriety. Thank you, God. That part you guys taught me early on, and I got it, and I have never lost that part. I don't care what is going on. I have been through doing life on life's terms, best I can, and have had the usual. I've had illnesses. I've had a lot of stuff. Anyway, but getting sober, I was very involved, and I truly believe in the service part of the program. I was introduced to service early. My first sponsor, you guys told me to get a nice lady sponsor, so I immediately got a long-haired hippie longshoreman. Yep, Frank Dwyer, but he was just what the doctor ordered. He really, truly was. Frank had an energy about him that was fabulous. He was very involved in service work. Service work was a big part of his program, and so he got me involved in service very, very early. And then along the way, well, I was sober maybe less than a year, he met a nice lady and fell in love, and he got married. So that was kind of the end of him being my sponsor. So I got another sponsor. My sponsor was Betty Laux. Until she died, she was my sponsor for about 36, 37 years, something like that. And we traveled all over the world together, as a matter of fact. We went to Europe to meetings. We went all over. We had a great time. Anyway, but she was not real big on service. To her, service was whatever, but she never stopped me or discouraged me from it. And I was very involved in service. And then there were some family issues that popped up, and I had to go back to them. You know, I often have muttered about, why am I a caregiver? Why do I have to always take care of everybody else? Blah, 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 blah. In the meantime, always saying thank you, God, for my sobriety, but I realized why I do it. I know it's an Al-Anon issue, which I will talk about in just 1 second, a little bit of Al-Anon there. But the important thing was, because I know how to do it so well. I do it so good. I came out of the chute taking care of people. I had no choice. I mean, in the situation at home, my mother needed help. I was the oldest. So therefore, I did it. Somebody had to do it because my father was either not there or drunk or whatever. So, and my mother had this blind grandmother and a cousin she had to take care of. So I was it. So I was well trained, and I still am well trained. I laugh about it, but I understand why I do it and how it come, because it's just been ingrained on me since, like I say, since I came out of the chute. But so I was very involved in service, but I had to back out of service because of the other issues of taking care of other people. And that's okay. First, I used to be a little resentful about that, but I'm not. I understand it just was what it was, and it's okay. I do think service work is very, very vital for sobriety. I really, truly do. I mean, for the kind of sobriety I like. I like being in service for other people. I know how to do it, and I enjoy it. But so I had to back off out of that. But there was a time I walked in the New York office and it was, "Hey, Karen, how are you?" You know, I was so well known around the country from going to various groups and all that kind of stuff that it was a lot of fun. And I, like I say, I would have proceeded on with it, but it just didn't go that way, and that's okay. As life went on, my one day, I went to Al-Anon. Now, I'm just gonna make a little plug here. Not everybody in Al-Anon needs Alcoholics Anonymous, but everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous needs to be some exposure to Al-Anon. There's no question about it, because that's a big issue. Our relationship problem is a big issue. Now, if nothing else, just to listen. Just to listen. And I must have said, I really enjoy Al-Anon. I don't go as much as I used to, but I did enjoy Al-Anon, and I still do, and I think it's a very, very important part of my sobriety anyway. I don't know about yours, but I owe a whole bunch to Al-Anon. In fact, Al-Anon totally changed my mind, changed my life. I was 20 years sober before I finally went to Al-Anon, and I can tell everyone, you know, do not wait for 20 years to go to Al-Anon. Go earlier. Even if you don't have nothing, I had nothing to share there so much as I just listened. So, Avalon taught me how to say no. And one day I went home, you know, I can't remember what the deal was with my, anyway, he wanted to take a big loan out on the house. And I said, no. And he said, what do you mean, no? I said, no, not at this stage of our lives are we going to take a big, big loan out on this house. And he said, I divorced thee. I mean, that's not really, it was a little bit more complicated than that. But it threw me into a total tizzy, took my whole world, such as my world was. And I was a real mess for a long while. But I got out of it, and through the years, been just fine. He's passed away since then, but I am so grateful that I managed to, you know, it was, I look back, in retrospect is what, 2020, isn't it? Hindsight, 2020. Mm-hmm. I look back and I can see what every piece in my life was all about now. At the time, it didn't, I think, you know, what the hell, you know, but at this time mm-hmm. in my life, I can look back and see what every single piece of it was. And why it was the way it was. And it wasn't how I wrote it or even thought about it, but that's the way it was. Because I truly believe when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had an experience. I had a spiritual experience that day that I said, I am an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic. And this feeling came over me from the top of my head right down to the bottom of my feet. And I think that's what the Christians call a conversion. Because something happened from that day on to this, that something just took over. And because I didn't know what I was supposed to do, but that was when I made the phone calls, and that's when I did all the things that just kind of happened and was out of my control. And so much of my life to this day still is out of my control, and I still understand. Today, I'm not going to say I understand why, because I make very poor choices. Left to my own device or my own thinking, I make very poor choices. I'm still doing things on impulse and still doing things because for the moment and all, oh God. But I think some of it just is what I am. But anyway, so, and like everybody, who's been prepared for this last year and a half we've been through? But I will say one thing, I do believe that an Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know I'm gonna say we on this, that we have a little edge on that program. Because they talked about the we thing, we can do this together. Well, we are so well conditioned on we can do this together that I think we have a little bit of a head start on those people that have struggled with that thing, because we can do it. We did it. We are doing it. I haven't spoken at a meeting for a long time, and I know I'm just kind of jumping around, but that's just the way it is. I got the COVID crazies. I admit it. I'm not ashamed of it. I've got it. But I look at it, COVID crazies are everybody. It's all over the world. I watch what's going on in the world, and I read the paper, I listen to the TV or whatever, and I think between the lines, and I'm like, well, that's, you know, COVID crazies. But you can't take a whole society and lock us up and just set us free and then say it's all going to be okay. It's sort of like, that's why we come to meetings. That's why I truly believe in the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and the gathering of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's why I was so thrilled when you asked me to talk. Whether I flub here or not isn't the point. It's the idea of wanting to be, I want to be involved in sobriety. I want to be involved in this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think what's with Aldous Huxley, what did he say about Alcoholics Anonymous? He said that it was the greatest invention since ice cream. No, he didn't say that. I said that. But he thinks it's the greatest thing that happened in the 20th century. And I truly agree with that. There's no question in my mind. I'm a big fan of, what's his name? Hold on, that's who I'm a fan of. But he says, I don't know who or what asked the question. I don't even remember answering. But at some moment I said yes, and my life in self-surrender has a goal. And that was, golly, why can't I remember his name? That's okay. He was anyway. But that's so true. That day that I said yes, I'm an alcoholic. My life, I surrendered. I surrendered that day. I didn't know I surrendered, but that was the day that I surrendered, and it was over. My life, as I had known it up to that point, it was never the same after that. That day that I, and that whole thing, that conversion thing came over me. It's not the same. It never will be the same again. Dag Hammarskjöld. Dag Hammarskjöld. I knew it would come to me. One of my heroes, truly one of my heroes. Of course, we're both Swedes, so what the hell? Anyway, but that's an accident. Anyway, but I'm a big fan of his too, and Aldous Huxley. Just simply by letting, and that's something I've really been working on lately, is letting, because I have, you know, there's always going to be this with all the things that we've gone through in this last year and a half. The more I'm letting go, the more it's okay. I let go, and I just tell myself over and over again, let go, just let go. And it happens. It all works out just like it's supposed to, without my phenomenal guidance. It's working. So I too have learned to accept myself, warts and all. I got a lot of warts, but there's some okay things about me too. I've gotten, as I've gotten older, and I feel what a privilege it is to have 50 years of sobriety. Oh, by the way, when I came into Alcoholics, I wasn't, Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't even 50 years old. That was the year that Bill Wilson died, and 1971, I think he died in March, February of that year, and I came in June. And one day I said, well, he sent me to take his place. And oh, God, the people went crazy. I said, that's a joke. But anyway, when I think about that, I think, and I had a wonderful opportunity. I spoke in Montreal for the 50th anniversary. I felt that was really an honor. That's when I was well connected in New York and knew all those people and all that kind of stuff. And had that wonderful, wonderful privilege of speaking there. And I know I spoke a lot better. I better go listen to some of those tapes. I might feel better. But I've had some of the experiences that I have had in Alcoholics Anonymous, be it negative, positive, at the moment, I can see how it has developed me, developed my sobriety, me as an individual, and how it has just totally changed how I look at the world. It's a whole new ballgame, and I'm eternally grateful to have given a bigger perspective of the whole thing, because without Alcoholics Anonymous, number one, I'd be dead. And I personally believe it is a privilege to be here. Now, everybody here is a pretty well-seasoned alcoholic, but it's a privilege. I say that to a new person, and I know they go, bleh. I would have gone maybe too, I don't know. But it's a privilege to be here, to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's enough out of me. I think that's enough out of me. And I thank you for the privilege of being able to do this evening. Thanks, I'm so proud of you too. I'm just thinking, Austria, I'm just so proud of what's going on down here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.